page 225 in the Hebrew, page 226 in the English. It's the middle of the second chapter of Shir HaShirim, and I want to start four lines from the top of the page. Hine zeh omed achar kosleinu. Behold, he stands on the other side of our wall. Mashkiach min hachalonos, looking in through the windows. Meitzitz min hacharakim, and peering or looking or staring through the latticework. Here we have the image on the level of the Jewish people, and also on the level of a person's personal relationship with God, where God is not apparent, God is invisible. So to the way we look at things, we would say that God is absent. But this verse means to teach us the difference between silence and absence. One can be silent and still present. And here we have God on the other side of our wall, that is outside, not immediately apparent. And the lesson that it wants to teach us is, even if it appears that God is absent, it's not true, it's a facade, it's not true. Rather, it is that God is giving the appearance of being absent, but is really on the other side of the wall. But even though God is on the other side of the wall, God is still looking through. God is still showing care and concern for us. And the best way to describe this is what happens in Kitty Corner every single day. You have parents that come and they drop off their children, and then the parents leave. So the child thinks that the parent has left. But very often, the parent has not left. And you see them, and you can watch them out here every morning, and you see mothers on the other side of the door, or a favorite place is in the kitchen, where there's a little glass window looking into the playroom. And the mothers are still there. Like, this, here's an example right now. The mothers are still there watching, even though the children on the inside think their parents have left. Their parents have never left. And they are, not only are they actually there, but they are concerned and they are watching and they are looking through the windows and looking through the latticeworks. I want you to remember this phrase, because this phrase is going to be is a foreshadowing of the fifth chapter. And we're going to look at that hopefully in a couple of weeks. And it's going to be a very dramatic and emotional discussion. And I want you just to keep this line in mind, because we're going to come back to it.
But he doesn't seem to be there, but he is.
Right. And that's a very, very important lesson on a personal level. There are times when we certainly feel abandoned by God. We feel that we're alone. And that's what Shir HaShirim wants to teach us. That is, we may feel like that, and there may be a reason for us feeling like that, but it's never the truth. It is always the appearance of absence. It's rather silence as opposed to absence. And that's a very, very important lesson. There is a place that we see this even more dramatically. The Talmud says that we actually act out this scene. And we act it out during the Birchas Kohanim, the priestly blessing. Now, our custom outside of Israel is that we only have the Birchas Kohanim. The Kohanim ascend to the Duchen, to the stage, and they give a bracha to the congregation. We only do that on the festivals of Yom Tov.
In Israel, they do it.
What's happening? What's happening is the Kohanim are transmitting a bracha. They are invoking a bracha. They are saying, Yivarechecha Hashem. Hashem, God, you should bless these people. And that is a part of the Kohen's job. I would say it's the most important part of a Kohen's job. And perhaps we'll talk about that at a different time. That's a very important subject. We'll talk about that at a different time. Our sages say that when the Kohanim say their bracha, the Kohanim hold their hands in a certain way. And they hold their hands like this. This, of course, was picked up by Dr. Spock in Star Trek. That's the Star Trek.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He had to come up with a signal, which meant peace. And so he chose this, because it means or represents peace. You'll see this sometimes, Nebuch, on tombstones for men who are Kohanim as a sign that they are a Kohen. What's going on? So what's going on with this thing? What's going on is our sages say that when the Kohanim give their blessing, it is a very holy and spiritual moment. And the Talmud says that when the Kohanim give their blessing, God's presence, the Shekhinah, rests above the hands of the Kohanim. So just imagine this for a moment. If the Shekhinah is above the hands of the Kohanim, what the Kohanim are doing with their hands is they are forming a lattice. That's what this is intended to reproduce. It's intended to reproduce a lattice. In other words, they are acting out this line of Shir HaShirim. When Shir HaShirim says that God is Netzitz min ha-charakim, the Kohanim acted out as if God is on the other side of this lattice work that they are holding. And that's literally the description of what's happening during Birchas Kohanim. What's happening during Birchas Kohanim is that even though God is far away, God is still watching and caring and blessing us. So that's why the Kohanim hold their hands in this way. We don't see it because the Gemara also says a person should not look at the hands of the Kohanim while they are doing Birchas Kohanim. Let's go in order. So, you're not supposed to look. Why are you not supposed to look? Because God's presence is right on top of the hands. So looking at the hands is like looking at God's presence, and you're not supposed to look at God's presence. So you're not supposed to look. It's very interesting. That's the reason that when a Kohen says Birchas Kohanim, he puts a talis over his hands. It's over his head also, but the purpose is to be over his hands. What's interesting is the custom that has developed among many Jews, and it doesn't seem to be completely easily understandable. And that is like this. The Gemara says, don't look at the hands of the Kohanim. So there are several ways to avoid looking at the hands of the Kohanim. One way, which is universal, is you put a talus over the Kohen's hands. Once you've done that, then there ought to be nothing wrong with looking. And yet, there are many people in congregations that have the practice, either if they're men, to put the talus over their own head, and if they have children, they'll put their children underneath the same talus. So it's a very beautiful moment, it's a very emotional moment, but the idea is that you shouldn't be looking. But the question is, if the reason not to look is not to see the hands, and the hands are already covered by the Kohen's talus, why should I have to cover my own talus? Then there's another practice. There's another practice that some people have, and I find this more among women who may not be wearing a talus. Some women will turn around.
This is what they were told. I think they don't know.
That's why we're having a class. So they turn around so that they're not looking. So I would like to offer my humble, respectful opinion that a better way not to look is to close your eyes.
No,
And I don't, and my own personal opinion is it's not respectful to turn around. How, I'm just explaining though, the reason that people turn around is like a double. That is, even if you were facing forward, you still wouldn't see the Kohen's hands. And it's seeing the Kohen's hands that is the problem. So my suggestion is, if you're wearing a talus, to cover your head with a talus if you want to. If you are not, to close your eyes. And but the whole issue is very interesting because it stems from this issue of not being able to see the hands of the Kohen. When I was a child, I remember someone telling me that that was a sign as to whether you were a Kohen. Because if you could do that, that proved that you were a Kohen. If you could not do that, that proved that you were not a Kohen. But there is no truth to that whatsoever. But that's a bubble mindset that I remember. Okay. The rest of this chapter, starting with the next verse, is this beautiful, beautiful description of nature. And it is appropriate that we're discussing this now, and I'm going to come back to it in a minute. Let's just see a couple of the verses and let's discuss them. I'm just skipping down a little bit. Ki hine hastav avar, kumi lach, rayasi yafasi. My beloved called and said to me, rise, my love, my beauty, come away with me. Ki hine hastav avar, because the winter has passed. Hageshem cholaf cholach lo. The season of rain has finished. So, you know, certainly in Israel, there's a rainy season during the winter, and then with spring, it ends. Hanitzanim nir'u v'aretz. The flowers are appearing in the earth. Eis hazamir higia. The time of song probably refers to the singing of birds has arrived. V'kol hator nishma b'aretzenu. The sound of the turtle dove can be heard. Hata'ena chanta pagea, the fig tree is ripening its figs. V'hagafanim smadar nasnu reach, and the grapevines are giving forth their beautiful smell. Kumi lach rayasi yafasi ulachila, come, get up, my beloved, come away with me. This is the time to go. This is the time to be together. This is the time of our greatest closeness because of the flowers and the smells and the fruits and the birds. And this is the time. It's beautiful poetry, just on the level of the pshat, just beautiful, beautiful poetry. Now, I told you before that items of nature are very important within Shir HaShirim. And I want to just take a few minutes to discuss the role that they play and the meaning that it has. For us, the flowering of nature in Israel, so it has a meaning in terms of culture and in terms of society, but for us it also has a theological meaning. This is a principle of religious Zionism.
It's like rebirth.
And, well, it's more than rebirth. It is that the flourishing in nature in Israel is a barometer of the relationship between God and the Jewish people that exists at that time. And this is a fundamental principle of religious Zionism that sees what happens in Israel as an indicator of what is happening within the neshama of the Jewish people. Famous phrase, this was first uttered, I believe, by I forgot who, one of the medieval poets, that not only is the bird loyal to its nest, the nest is also loyal to the bird. Every other land, there's no such thing as a land responding to its people, except for Israel. Israel is unique in that the land of Israel responds to its people. And so, when Jews leave Israel, the land of Israel is desolate.
It's like you said last week, the altar cries when somebody gets a gift.
Right. And here you see it in nature. In nature. And this is true. Throughout our exile, when we have not been in Israel, the land becomes barren. And when we come back to Israel, the land is showing us her loyalty. That she did not give her produce to anyone else. Israel does not give its produce, has never given its produce to anyone else. After the destruction of the first temple, when Jews were exiled to Babylonia, the land was desolate, was completely destroyed. Nothing was happening there for 100 years until the Jews came back, etc., etc. When Jews came back in the 1800s, it was again desolate. But Israel, when Jews came back to Israel in the 1800s and found mostly desert land, it hadn't been desert land for centuries. It had not been. It had been completely fertile. The land of Israel does not flourish for anyone else except the Jewish people. And this is what we mean when we use this phrase, you know, in the prayer for the government, prayer for the state of Israel, that we say on Shabbos, we use the phrase "Reishis Tzemichas Geulaseinu," is the first flowering of our redemption, and we mean that in two levels. We mean that as a metaphor, the flowering of redemption, but we choose that metaphor because it is a literal statement. The physical flowering is the indicator of the spiritual flowering of redemption. This year is a Jewish leap year. That means approximately once every 3 years we add an extra month of Adar. Why do we add an extra month of Adar? If the calendar is a lunar calendar that follows the cycles of the moon, why do we add an extra month? So the reason is as follows. Because the lunar month is 354 days long, and the lunar year, 12 cycles of the month, 354 days long, and the solar year is 365 days long, 11 days difference. So, if you could imagine, just to give you an example, Pesach, on year one, whatever year you want to start.
28 days?
If you take Pesach just arbitrarily on year one, that falls on April 1st. If you had just a lunar calendar, next year Pesach would be 11 days earlier on the solar calendar. That would mean it would be middle of March. Second year, it would be the beginning of March. And what would happen is, year by year, Pesach would be observed all the way around the calendar. In fact, that is how the Islamic calendar does run. Islam uses a purely, exclusively lunar calendar, and their holidays occur at different times of the year, every year, because they're always moving 11 days earlier. Why is it? So what we really have is a lunar calendar that is corrected by the solar calendar. So it's 11 days a year. Approximately every 3 years is about a month earlier. So we add a month and we push it back a month.
Well, why did we pick Adar?
Well, why do we pick Adar, number one? And number two, why do we have to correct it for the sun? Why not have the same calendar that just has the holidays moving around the year?
Yeah.
The answer is because of Pesach. The Torah says that Pesach is called Chag Ha'aviv, the holiday of springtime. In other words, Pesach must be in the springtime. So if it gets too early and it's into the winter, you cannot have Pesach. That's why it's necessary, and that's why we add the Adar. That's why we have to add the month of Adar, because the question is, when we get to Adar, can we have Pesach now, or do we have to delay Pesach for another 4 weeks? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. So that's why the month that we add is the month of Adar. But the purpose of it, and that's the whole calendar, is based on this concept. The purpose is to make sure that Pesach should be in the spring. Why is it so important to the Torah that Pesach should be in the spring? Reason is because the Torah wants the original redemption happen in the spring. And the Torah wants what happens in nature to be a metaphor for what happens spiritually. So the Torah wants us to be able to see the approach of spring and say, this is the time of redemption. Eis hazamir higia. The time of singing has come. And that only takes place if every year Pesach remains in the spring.
What do we do when we're supposed to be clear?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer for that. That's a good question.
Because that is the beginning of winter, right?
Right. This only works in the Northern Hemisphere. I don't have a good answer for that.
Oh my God.
In other words, what you see is that this paragraph not only describes a past event, it also is built into the fabric of our calendar so that we are able to see this every single year. And therefore, the lesson we're supposed to learn is that historical redemption foreshadows our own redemption. And what we hope every year, and that's the reason that, at least according to one tradition, the Mashiach will come in the month of Nisan, sometime around Pesach time. That's one tradition that we have. Because that is the time of redemption. How do you know it's the time of redemption? Because even the natural world in Israel reflects the flourishing and the closeness of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. That, of course, is one of the major debates between religious Zionists and other religious Jews. That is, Jews who are religious Jews but are not Zionistic, let's call them a-Zionist, that is, they do not see significance, spiritual significance in what happens in the land of Israel. There's something that bothers me, if you don't mind, I want to just take a moment. I spoke about this a number of weeks ago, but I just want to clarify this. We talk about Jews who are anti-Zionist. I think we need just to clarify that. Anti-Zionist is really limited, I think, to a very, very small fringe group of people who actively agitate against the state of Israel. That's like the handful of crazy people that protested at the Yom HaAtzmaut rally, and that's disturbing and upsetting and they're wrong, but that's a rather small isolated group. There is a larger group that I would call either non-Zionists or a-Zionists, and what I mean by that is as follows. If you ask, and this applies, by the way, to a large part of the Utrama community, the so-called yeshiva world, and also large parts of the so-called Hasidic world.
Yeah, and the if
you would ask them, is the land of Israel holy and special? They would say, yes, of course, it's holy and special. If you would say to them, is there a lot of Torah in Israel? They'd say, of course, there's a lot of Torah in Israel. But if you would say to them, the fact that there is a flourishing state in Israel, does that tell you anything about God's attitude towards the Jewish people? They would say, no, that we don't agree to. That is, we don't agree, they would say, that there's any connection between the secular state, what happens to the secular state, and the spiritual reality. It's two separate things. The spiritual reality, they would say, can only come from a spiritual state, cannot come from a secular state. What we would say is that there's a connection. What happens in the physical realm is connected to what happens in the spiritual realm. And in fact, the physical realm is a barometer of the spiritual realm as well. That's the dispute. I just want to, obviously I'm taking one. Let's go on to the next chapter, Perek Gimel, the third chapter. Al Mishkavi Balelos. On my bed at night, meaning while I was in bed at night, bikashti eshava nafshi, I sought out, I wanted to be close to the one that my soul loves. Bikashti v'lo matzasiv, I sought him out, but I did not find him. So here you have, within the historical level, the first separation, the first distancing between God and the Jewish people. Everything was great, everything was perfect, it was springtime, and then all of a sudden, you know, something cooled off. So, akulana v'asovu v'ir, so I got up, and I started going around the city, it's nighttime, and I went to the marketplaces and the streets, and I was looking around, I went searching for my beloved, and mitzauni hashomrim hasovu v'ir, I'm skipping down a little bit towards the bottom of the place, I saw the watchman in the city, and I said, have you seen my beloved? I found him. There was a temporary separation, and then I found him. And when I found him, achazti v'lo arpenu, I held him and would not let go. Achahaveisiv el beis imi, until I had brought him into my mother's home, v'el cheder horosi, and into the room where I was conceived. And top of the next page, Hishbati eschem benos Yerushalayim, I make you take an oath, maidens of Jerusalem, im ta'iru v'im ta'oru es ha'ava achetechpatz. Do not stir up, do not rouse up my beloved until it pleases him. Meaning, remember, this is the second repetition of this verse. It's going to be repeated three times, so I'm going to wait and talk about that verse when we have it all three times, the three oaths. But you have this narrative where there is this separation, and she goes looking, and then she finds him. And when she finds him, she holds him tight. So, first of all, just on the level of pshat, on the simple level, you see here a process that happens to everybody, and this is something that people in a relationship need to be aware of, and especially people who have just gotten married, and that is that there are cycles to a relationship. It goes up and it goes down, it gets stronger and it gets a little weaker. When it gets a little bit weaker, a person should not despair. A person should rather recognize that there's a problem and then take the steps to change it, to correct it. A relationship has to be pursued, literally, as well as figuratively. Here, she is literally running after the relationship. So it's not just enough to say, you know, however it is, that's how it is. You have to run after it. You have to pursue it. You have to work on it. And if a person's in a relationship and they're in a trough, they're in a period where it's lower, they have to work to make it get better. One of the frightening things for a newly married couple is the first time they have a fight. Because many people get married thinking that that means that we're going to love each other forever. And if we have a fight, that means that it's over. And the relationship cannot continue. And that's, of course, a terrible misunderstanding. And a lot of people have a lot of pain because of that misunderstanding. What we need to teach people who are about to get married is, you're going to have arguments. But here's a way to have an argument, number one. And number two, here's a way to be able to overcome an argument, to be able to get past an argument.
How to give everybody free space.
That's a very important part of it.
The husband and the children and the grandchildren.
That's a very important part of it. How to fight fairly, how to fight correctly, how to fight respectfully. That's a very, very important part of relationships. That's on the simplest level, you see this. On the level of the history between God and the Jewish people, this could refer to the period of 38 and a half years in the desert. You know, it's really incredible, and you can easily miss this. If you read through the narratives of the Torah, everything in the five books of Moses, let's just talk about from the time the Jewish people leave Egypt, that's in the middle of the book of Shmos, they leave Egypt, until the end of the fifth book of the Torah, they are about to enter Israel and Moshe dies. Okay? That's a period of about 40 years. 40 years. Okay? Everything that is in the Torah, almost everything that is in the Torah, only relates to 1.5 years of those 40 years. The first year and about 2 months, that led up to the time of the sin of the spies. The Jews left Egypt, Pesach time. 7 weeks later, they get to Sinai. Then over the summer is the problem with the golden calf. Moshe comes down with a second set of tablets at Yom Kippur. Commands them to build the Mishkan. They build the Mishkan. It's dedicated Nisan. 1 year after leaving Egypt, they have the Mishkan. They are about to go into Israel. They send spies. That's Tammuz. That's the beginning of the summer. And then comes the sin of the report that the spies bring back. God says, you're going to wander in the desert for a total of 40 years. You're not going into Israel, you're going to wander. The next narrative that we have is in the 39 and a half year, I didn't say that right. The next narrative is 38 years later. Yeah. 6 months before they're about to enter the land of Israel. Miriam dies, then Aharon dies, and then we get ready for Moshe's death. That occurs within a 6 month period, the last 6 months of the 40 years. Between the time of the spies and the time that we come back to the Jewish people when Miriam dies, that's 38 and a half years approximately. No narrative, no story, nothing happens that we know about. There's one place in the Torah, in the Parsha of Masai, at the end of the book of Bamidbar, that it lists the names of the places that they went to during that time. But there's no narrative.
It's all about the Mishkan and the...
But it's over. It's over. It's an empty period. Out of 40 years, 38 and a half years are blank.
But we know about the manna.
Well, we know they were wandering somewhere in the desert. They were being fed by God. They were being led to different places by God. We assume they studied Torah. You know, their clothes didn't wear out. They had food. But there's no narrative. There are no mitzvos that are given to them during that time, apparently. Because God is not speaking to them. God is not speaking to them during that time. There is a, it's like going behind the moon. It's like the blackout period. Because what God says is, I'm upset with you, with the generation that accepted the spies' report about Israel. I'm going to wait until that generation has died out, and the new generation will go in. The time it took for that generation to die out, there's no more contact. That's what's being referred to here. I got up, she says, and I'm looking for my beloved. My beloved is not there. I don't know where it is. But instead of giving up, instead of following someone else, she goes looking. And she goes searching. And that's the process that took 38 years, 38 and a half years. And she goes looking. And she goes out and she goes looking. Until finally, she is reunited. And she's reunited when the Jewish people are able to enter the land of Israel. You know, the beginning of the book of Joshua tells us that when the Jews entered the land of Israel, they came in from what is now Jordan. That means they crossed the Jordan River. The Jordan River split. The same miracle that had occurred 40 years earlier in the Red Sea, leaving Egypt, the exact same miracle occurred to the Jews 40 years later in the Jordan River
with Joshua.
And the sameness of the miracle means to indicate to us that the level was the same. Just like the Jews after leaving Egypt were on this very, very close relationship, and then it went down because of the sins the Jews committed, it came back up by the end of the 40 years. So the same miracle, the same nes is repeated. And that's how they went into the land of Israel. Now, what I want you to do is, again, I want you to hold on to this narrative of this woman being in bed and going out and looking for her beloved. Because again, we're going to see this repeated, and it's going to be an amazing and emotional issue. Just look at the last verse, the last pasuk of this chapter, the third chapter. Se'ena ure'ena. Go forth and gaze, Benos Sion, daughters of Zion, Bamelech Shlomo, at King Solomon, Ba'atarashi itra lo imo, at the crown that his mother made for him, Biyom Chasunaso, on the day of his marriage, Ubiyom Simchas Libo, and the day of his greatest joy. So you should be able to recognize that's the title of a very well-known work, Senarena. And it comes from usually it's pronounced with a Yiddish pronunciation, Senarena, yeah. But Se'ena Ure'ena, it was the title of a work that was written for women, and it is a commentary to the portion of the week, together with Midrashim on the portion of the week, together with prayers to be said, and for generations, women, especially in Europe, would use Senarena. That was their sefer. That was their main learning and praying, came from Senarena for many generations. And the title comes from this verse, because it is for Benot Sion, the daughters of Zion, so it's intended to be something for women to use. This word atara is translated here as crown. You should just know that there's another translation, and that is atara is a collar piece. And what this refers to is the atara that is worn on a talis. Sometimes it's embroidered, sometimes it's silver. An atara, meaning the collar piece or the crown piece of the talis. And this is a verse that is used to support the practice that a man starts to wear talis when he gets married. Because you see that the atara, she'itra lo imo, the atara is made for him, biyom chasunaso, on the day of his marriage. There is some connection, at least not literally, but at least metaphorically, between a talis and marriage, and that is the source or one of the sources of the Ashkenazic practice that a man starts to wear a talis when he gets married. There are other practices that have other sources, but this verse is wearing a kittel at a wedding is because a marriage is a personal Yom Kippur. It's a day of atonement. And a kittel is a white garment that symbolizes tshuva and repentance. And
it reminds us that we're all mortal.
It reminds us that we're all mortal, but more than that, it reminds us that a chasan and kala start marriage as new people. And it's a new leaf in their life, and they are starting a new chapter, and they are able to come without carrying the baggage of their previous lives. Let's look at one more thing before we stop for today. Look at the beginning of the next chapter, chapter 4. Here's a description that the beloved, the God, or that the man is giving of his beloved, of this woman. So, Hinach Yafa Rayasi, Hinach Yafa, you're beautiful, in Ayach Yonim, your eyes are like the eyes of a turtle dove, your hair, right? Your teeth are clean and white. Your lips are scarlet. Kefelach, the fourth line in the Hebrew, Kefelach Harimon Rakasech. This is not really a good translation. Kefelach Harimon Rakasech. Rakasech is your cheek. Your cheeks are like the curve of a pomegranate. So what this means is, and this is something that is certainly true today, a sign of beauty in a woman is high and well-formed cheekbones. Katharine Hepburn, Meryl Streep, cheekbones. That's what this is. That's what it means. It means that the cheekbones are prominent. I'm sorry, what? What?
I have a what?
Well, I'm just referring to the cheeks right now. There is an interesting connection of this fruit, pomegranates. One of the great things about being in Israel is to have good access to fresh pomegranates. It's rare to get really good pomegranates because they are so sweet and they are so juicy.
I always had a problem with the seeds.
When I was in Israel, living in Israel, my school, my yeshiva, used to serve pomegranates every day for lunch during the winter. And it's just unbelievably delicious. So there is a tradition. And the tradition is that if you count the number of seeds in a pomegranate, there are 365 seeds in a pomegranate. Okay? I don't know if it's true. I don't know if there are always the same number of seeds. But that's the tradition that you find.
That could be a genetic thing too, you know.
Could be. But the significance of the number 365, in addition to being the number of days in the solar year, is that is the number of positive commandments in the Torah. There are 365 positive commandments in the Torah, and 200 and whatever it takes to make it up to 613, 200 whatever to negative commandments in the Torah. In other words, there is a connection. A pomegranate is a metaphor or a representation of the fulfillment of the positive mitzvahs of the Torah. And there is a line in the Talmud that goes as follows. It is a play on words of this phrase. Rakosech, which means your cheekbone. Your cheekbone is like a pomegranate. Rakosech is similar to a word called Rekanim Shebecha. Now, Rekanim means empty ones. And the Talmud says, Rekanim Shebechem, the empty ones among you, Malei Mitzvos Karimon, are as full of mitzvos as a pomegranate. In other words, what the Talmud means to say is, even a person, you shouldn't judge people. And you shouldn't try to evaluate, is this person religious or not religious? Is this person a good person, not a good person? Only God can truly judge somebody. And it's very hard to tell, because even a person who appears to be non-religious, however you define that, may actually perform many, many, many mitzvahs. And may be a very holy person. There's no way for us to know. So, Rekanim Shebechem, even the empty ones among you, are Malei Mitzvos Karimon. They are filled with mitzvos like a pomegranate, based on this illusion that a pomegranate has 365 mitzvos. And we see that all the time, because even a person who's not religious in one sense may be doing something else that is another sense. Every time a person tells the truth, that's a mitzvah. Every time a person desists from doing a sin, that is a mitzvah. Every time a person is tempted to do something and they overcome that temptation, that is a mitzvah. So it's not possible for us to evaluate. And the fact is that people really do many more mitzvos than they are aware of. A lot of people think a mitzvah means if you put the coin in the tzedakah or if you come to shul, a specific action. But there are a lot of things that we do in our daily lives that are in fact
good natured.
Right. And those are mitzvahs. Every time we're kind to somebody, every time we say something that is true, that is another mitzvah. So it's a play on woolly. Those people who are empty of other mitzvahs, but they are still as filled with mitzvos as a pomegranate. And that is a particularly important lesson, I think today in particular, to remember the way we look at Jews. If a person could just remember this, Malei Mitzvos Karimon applies to every single Jew, especially if you're involved in a shul. The attitude that you have to have for every single person that comes in. So often it happens that someone will come in and people will say, well, you know, he's not wearing a yarmulke, or she's not doing this, or they're not acting this way. And, of course, the people that are talking are maybe not all that religious themselves, but they can look down.
God, you know?
But they can look down on somebody else, and it's the wrong attitude. We ought to have the attitude. Every single person that walks in is Malei Mitzvos Karimon, is as filled with mitzvos as a pomegranate has seeds, and that ought to be the basis of our attitude towards them.